Hello. Today is Monday, December 14th, and it's time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be sharing with you today stories from the Sioux City Journal. We're going to start out with the weather, check out the mini editorial, and then look at all sorts of stories, both of local interest, state interest, and nationwide. So let's get started. What's happening in the weather? Well, it is a little bit cooler this week. Today, partly sunny, high of 28, low of 15 tonight. Tomorrow, cloudy, high of 31, low of 13. Partly sunny on Wednesday with a little warmer, high of 33, lower of 18. Sunshine and milder on Thursday, high of 42, low of 24. And thick cloud cover will come on Friday, but still mild temperature of 43, low of 23. So get your coat on if you go outside, but at least we don't have a lot of snow hitting our area. So let's go back to today's mini editorial. Today's mini is written by Dale Henningsen of Sergeant Bluff. And Dale says, "The mini from November 21st by FG was very true. Make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they'll believe it. Guess who does this? The Democrats, the liberal news media, liberal big tech like Twitter, Facebook, and Google. Why did the news media and big tech censor the New York Post for the story about Biden's pay for play with the Ukraine oil company and another company out of China?" This is the opinion of Dale Henningsen of Sergeant Bluff. Let's get to our front page stories. Today's headline, again today, Monday, December 14th, is "Vaccine Shipments Begin." Shots are expected to start this week in a historic U.S. effort. From Portage, Michigan, the first of many freezer-packed COVID-19 vaccine vials made their way to distribution sites across the U.S. on Sunday, as the nation's pandemic deaths approached the horrifying new milestone of 300,000. The rollout of the Pfizer vaccine, the first to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration, ushers in the biggest vaccine effort in U.S. history, one that health officials hope an American public will embrace, even if, as some have voiced initial skepticism or worry. Shots are expected to be given to healthcare workers and nursing home residents beginning Monday. Quick transport is key for the vaccine, especially since this one must be stored at extremely low temperatures, 94 degrees below zero. Early Sunday, workers at Pfizer, dressed in fluorescent yellow clothing, hard hats, and gloves, wasted no time as they packed vials into boxes. They scanned the packages and placed them into freezer cases with dry ice. The vaccines were taken from Pfizer's Portage, Michigan facility to Gerald R. Ford International Airport in Grand Rapids, where the first cargo plane took off amid what airport officials called a jubilant mood. "This is a historic day," said Richard Smith, who oversees operations in the Americas for FedEx Express, which is delivering some 630 packages of vaccines to distribution sites across the country. United Parcel Service, or UPS, is also transporting a share of the vaccine. Helping with the transport of the vaccine has special meaning to Bruce Smith, a FedEx package handler at the Grand Rapids Airport, whose older sister, Queen, died after she contracted the coronavirus in May. She was hospitalized in Georgia one day after he saw her on a video chat, and they never spoke again. "I think she would be ecstatic to know that something has ravaged our family, that a family member is going to be a part of such a big project," said Smith, 58, whose nephew, Queen's son, also got sick and is still undergoing therapy for stroke-like symptoms. "It is very, very important." Tracked with GPS-enabled sensors, the initial shipments were expected to contain about 3 million doses, with many more to come. Federal officials say the first shipments of Pfizer vaccines will be staggered, arriving in 145 distribution centers Monday, with another 425 sites getting shipments on Tuesday and the remaining 66 on Wednesday. Doses of the vaccine, co-developed by German partner BioNTech, were given out based on each state's adult population. Then the states decide where they go first. In California, where healthcare workers will be among the first to be vaccinated, state health officials are prioritizing hospitals that have adequate storage capacity, serve high-risk populations, and have the ability to vaccinate people quickly. Initial surveys have found that even some healthcare workers don't want to be first in line. Dr. Graham Snyder, who's led the vaccine task force in Pennsylvania healthcare giant UPMC, estimates that about half of the employees are willing to get the vaccine as soon as it's offered. But many health officials expect enthusiasm to grow. There's that thought that maybe they don't have to be so afraid to come to work if they get vaccinated and that they're immune. Employees approved for the first round are getting texts and emails directing them to schedule their initial injection. Enough vaccine is being saved so that each person who gets the first dose can get a second required shot a few weeks later. Senior U.S. government officials, including some officials who work in close proximity to President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, are among those who will be offered coronavirus vaccines as soon as this week. Two people familiar with the matter confirmed. A survey from the AP NORC Center for Public Affairs Research found that about half of the Americans want to get the vaccine as soon as possible. Another quarter are not sure, while the remaining quarter say they are not interested. Some simply oppose vaccines in general. Others are concerned that the vaccines have been rushed and want to see how the rollout goes. Dr. Stephen Hahn, commissioner of the FDA, which approved the Pfizer vaccine on Friday, has repeatedly insisted the agency's decision was based on science, not politics, despite a White House threat to fire him if the vaccine was not approved before Saturday. Speaking to Fox News on Sunday, Dr. Moncef Saloui, chief science advisor to Operation Warp Speed, a U.S. effort to get vaccines developed quickly, also said he is very concerned about the skepticism about the vaccine in some circles. Unfortunately, there's been a confusion between how thorough and scientific and factual the work that has been done is, and the perception that people are thinking that we cut corners. I can guarantee you that no such things have happened and that we follow the science. He called the development of the vaccines from several pharmaceutical companies, including Moderna and AstraZeneca, a remarkable achievement of science, academia, the industry ecosystem, and the U.S. government working together. While the vaccine was determined to be safe, regulators in the U.K. are investigating several severe allergic reactions. The FDA's instructions tell providers not to give it to those with a known history of severe allergic reactions to any of its ingredients. The Moderna vaccine will be reviewed by an expert panel on Thursday and soon afterward could be allowed for public use. That is our first front page story about the vaccine. We also have a very colorful picture of help for the holidays, and it is a picture of Gary Turbis from Midstep Services, the executive director, and Mary Bertram, the agency's development director, talk about Adopt a Midstep Services Home for the Holidays program, which encourages the public to donate gifts to bring Christmas cheer to Midstep clients with intellectual disabilities. The two are shown with some donated items at Midstep Sioux City offices. There's a very colorful picture of all sorts of toys and games and markers and gifts with Gary and with Mary Bertrand in the background. Adopt a Midstep Home. Agency encouraging donation of games, crafts, and other gift items. With Christmas just around the corner, it's always nice to spread a bit of seasonal cheer. That's why community members are encouraged to adopt a Midstep Home, Midstep Services Home for the holidays. providing residential, vocational, educational, and recreational services to people with intellectual disabilities, Midstep Services has 35 homes in Sioux City, Sergeant Bluff, Lawton, and Cherokee. Currently, those homes are occupied by 250 residents. Just like everyone else, our members have had their Christmases impacted by concerns over COVID-19, said Development Director Mary Bertram. Unlike other years, they'll be at home without much to do. Knowing this, Jan Turbis, wife of the Midstep Executive Director Gary Turbis, had seen similar organizations asking the public to contribute wish list items to be used at group homes. Such items can include things like jigsaw puzzles or puzzle books, holiday crafts, gingerbread houses, all sorts of things. Board games, card games, art supplies, markers, crayons, and coloring books. Coloring books are so much fun because they're therapeutic. Other popular items have included baking kits, gingerbread houses, and jigsaw puzzles. I know my grandchildren's like puzzles. Me, I don't have that sort of patience. Wrapped or unwrapped gifts may be dropped off at Midstep Services' main office at 4303 Stone Avenue between 8 and 4, Monday through Friday. The gifts will then be distributed between now and Christmas. I can't tell you how happy our members are when they received an unexpected gift, especially something that can bring hours of fun. It is heartwarming for the gift givers as well. I know grandparents are getting their grandchildren involved. They'll go shopping for the family and maybe pick up something extra for Midstep Services. Since putting out the word for the organization's Adopt a Midstep Services Home for the Holiday campaign, Turbis has been gratified by the positive response. With the pandemic, it seemed like everything has changed. I'm so happy that people are willing to open their hearts. While Adopt a Midstep Services Home for the Holidays was conceived with coronavirus concerns in the back of everyone's mind, Bertrand would like it to become an annual event. It feels good to spread some holiday cheer, she said. In other front page news, deaths in Woodbury County hit 145. Hospitalizations on the decline in Sioux City. Another two deaths attributed to COVID-19 have been recorded in Woodbury County. The county's death toll now stands at 145, according to the Siouxland District Health Department and the Iowa Department of Public Health. Last week, the Iowa Department of Public Health changed its methodology for recording deaths, which initially caused the county's official toll to drop by 14 down to 126. Since then, the toll has risen. Woodbury County also added another 39 infections on Sunday, a low figure compared to the sometimes triple-digit single-day tallies seen frequently in recent weeks. The number of patients in Sioux City hospitals has improved. As of Sunday, 34 patients were hospitalized in Sioux City because of the virus, while another 22 have the virus but are hospitalized for another health issue. Hospitalization numbers have slid considerably from 2 weeks ago. Total number of hospitalized patients with COVID-19 is down 41% from November 29th. To date, more than 11% of the Woodbury County's population has known to have the COVID-19 infection. Our last front page story is the U.S. Treasury and Commerce Departments are hacked. In Washington, D.C., hackers broke into the network of federal agencies, including the Treasury and Commerce Departments, as U.S. government officials said Sunday they're working to identify the scope of the breach and to fix the problem. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security's cybersecurity arm are investigating. The hacks were revealed just days after a major cybersecurity firm disclosed that foreign government hackers had broken into its network and stolen the company's own hacking tools. Many experts suspect Russia as responsible for the attack against FireEye, a major cybersecurity player whose customers include federal, state, and local governments and top global corporations. There was no immediate connection between the attacks, and it was not immediately clear if Russia was also responsible for the hack of the Treasury Department, which was first reported by Reuters. National Security Council spokesperson John Elliott said in a statement that the government was taking all necessary steps to identify and remedy any possible issues related to this outbreak. The government's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency said separately that it has been working with other agencies regarding recently discovered activity on government networks. CISA is providing technical assistance to affected entities as they work to identify and mitigate any potential compromises. President Donald Trump last month fired the director of CISA, Chris Krebs, after Krebs vouched for the integrity of the presidential election and disputed Trump's claims of widespread electoral fraud. Federal government agencies have long been attractive targets for foreign hackers. Hackers linked to Russia were able to break into the State Department email system in 2014, infecting it so thoroughly that it had to be cut off from the internet while experts worked to eliminate the infestation. Reuters earlier reported that a group backed by a foreign government stole information from the Treasury and a Commerce Department agency responsible for deciding internet and telecommunications policy. Intelligence agencies are reportedly concerned that other agencies were hacked using similar tools. The Treasury Department deferred comment to the National Security Council. A Commerce Department spokesperson confirmed a breach in one of our bureaus and said we have asked CISA and the FBI to investigate. Last Tuesday, prominent U.S. cybersecurity firm FireEye said that foreign government hackers with world-class capabilities broke into its network and stole offensive tools it uses to probe the defenses of its thousands of customers. Those customers include federal, state, and local governments and top global corporations. The hackers primarily sought information related to certain government customers, FireEye CEO Kevin Mandana said in a statement without naming them. He said there was no indication they got customer information from the company's consulting or breach response businesses or threat intelligence data it collects. FireEye responded to the Sony and Equifax data breaches and helped Saudi Arabia thwart an oil industry cyber attack, and has played a key role in identifying Russia as the protagonist in numerous aggressions in the burgeoning netherworld of global digital conflict. Neither Mandina nor a FireEye spokesperson said when the company detected the hack or who might be responsible, but many in the cybersecurity community suspect Russia. All right, we're going to turn now to page A2. As we have read all of the front page stories. Rotary names December Student of the Month. Bishop Heelan High School senior Avery Nelson has been named the December 2020 Rotary Student of the Month. Nelson was honored during a virtual Rotary Club meeting on December 8th. Avery Nelson is Bishop Heelan High School Student Body Vice President, Rotary Interact Co-President, a member of the National Honor Society, and captain of her volleyball team. She has been awarded the Bishop Heelan Student of the Year in Math, Science, and Social Studies, and has been a volunteer academic peer tutor and Math B coach. She is the daughter of Zachary and Lisa Nelson. In other local state, it is pure exhaustion, is the headline title. Frontline healthcare workers describe COVID experience. There's a picture of Cynthia Morella, an internal medicine nurse at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinic. She says, in the back of your mind, you're thinking of your own families. You're trying to be as thorough as possible in using safety precautions because you don't want to take COVID-19 home to a family member. In Des Moines, exhaustion, physical and emotional exhaustion. That's what Iowa's frontline healthcare workers are feeling right now as COVID-19 rages through the state 9 months into the pandemic. Frontline healthcare workers have been dealing with the pandemic ever since it reached Iowa in March. Almost 9 months later, COVID-19 surged through Iowa at a rate never before seen. Cases quadrupled their previous high, and hospitalizations tripled their previous highest mark that was in May. That unprecedented surge has left Iowa hospitals reeling, and the workers on the front lines are feeling the impact deeply. The refrain from those workers is consistent. They're physically and emotionally exhausted. To have the worst of it happening so long into this battle, everyone was already tired, and now everyone's working even harder than they were, said Kristen Brainerd, a nurse practitioner in the intensive care unit at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. It's pure exhaustion. It's not just physical. A lot of this is mental exhaustion. Nurses interviewed for this story said they do not yet feel short-staffed, in part because their hospitals have taken necessary steps, like shifting nurses from other areas to help care for the COVID-19 patients. But they said their work is becoming increasingly taxing as the number of COVID hospitalizations skyrocketed during the month of November. For much of the pandemic, the highest two-week average of daily new COVID-related hospital admissions was 40. On November 22nd, that average was 211. The surge has forced nurses and other frontline workers to work long hours, often in an area where they are not accustomed to working. Everyone's getting called upon to do a little bit beyond and above what you've typically done. And actually, we've been doing this for quite a few months now. And everyone's really tired of it, said Barbara Stanerson, a senior physical therapist at the University of Iowa Hospitals. But you know, we're still there for the patients, and we're doing everything we can to make it safe and get these patients back on their feet. The job has taken an emotional toll as well as nurses have to watch COVID patients die, often without family members at their side due to safety precautions. I've been a nurse for over a decade now, and it's one of the hardest battles I've ever had to fight in my life at work, said Lily Olson, a nurse in the medical intensive care unit at the University of Iowa Hospital, her voice cracking with emotion as she spoke. We try our darndest every day, and unfortunately we lose battles. We don't like it. It affects us a lot, emotionally, mentally, physically, because it's exhausting work. Olson spoke over a video call while preparing lunch for her three children, some of whom could be heard in the background. She said it's not just the job that weighs on healthcare workers, it's bringing the job home, figuratively, by still reeling from the physical and emotional effects of a shift, and literally with the fear of contracting the virus and spreading it to their families. I come home from work and I just want to go to bed, but there are other things I have to do. It's not just a work thing, because when we're at home, we think about work. Didn't used to be that way for me. I used to be able to come home and relax and not worry about it. But you're physically exhausted, and I have three kids to take care of. Three kids is a lot of work. It's hard to give them my full energy, because I use a lot of it at work, said Cynthia Marilla, an internal medicine nurse at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinic. In the back of your mind, you're thinking of your own families. You're trying to be as thorough as possible using all the safety precautions because you just don't want to take it home to a family member. And it's not just their own families about which healthcare workers are concerned. They also feel for the families of the COVID patients. Often family members are unable to visit patients because of safety concerns. I just feel so terrible because one of the main and most important things for good patient outcomes is to have a support system, is to have their families. And these people don't have it. They can't have it in the way they need it. The risk is just too high. COVID is making devastation across everywhere. Nurses said they've been forced to have difficult end-of-life discussions with family members over the phone instead of in person. There is good news. The recent surge may be subsiding and the COVID-19 vaccines are on the way. After hitting those dangerous and unprecedented peaks in late November, COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations have been declining over the past 2 weeks. However, those figures remain dramatically higher than the previous peak over the summer. The first batches of the vaccines are expected to arrive in Iowa this week. The state, based off federal guidance, has determined hospital and other healthcare workers, along with staff and residents at long-term care facilities like nursing homes, will be prioritized to receive the vaccinations first. But it will be months before the vaccine is available to the general public. In the meantime, those frontline workers pleaded with Iowans not to let their guard down in the ongoing battle to prevent the virus spread. They asked everyone to continue washing their hands, staying 6 feet away from others, and wearing face masks when in public around others. My number one thing is not to let a stabilization of cases make you put your guard down. The moment that those guards come down in the community and people tend to relax on restrictions and mandates, that is COVID's prime opportunity to wreak havoc. It's just so, so important to be vigilant, to be cautious, and to do your part in the community to contain it. Marula implored Iowans to do their part, not just to help healthcare workers, but to save lives. Even if you don't care about getting COVID, if you could care less, if you got it, do it for your mother or your sibling or your own child. Love somebody enough to protect them. Okay, we're going to continue on with other stories of local interest. We talked about the weather. Guess what? It's countdown to Christmas, 11 days left. Here's an FAQ. I have a question for your Siouxland Life doctor. How do I submit a question? Just send it to Doc. I've got a question. CO of the Siouxland Life, 515 Pavonia Street, Sioux City, Iowa, 51102. Today's speak out is, how far along are you in your Christmas shopping? I hope that if you're doing online shopping that you realize that some of your shipping days are winding down. All right, we're going to go on to some nation and world news. The UK EU leaders extend the Brexit talks. The topsy-turvy trade talks between the UK and the European Union took another somersault on Sunday when Boris Johnson opted to ignore a self-imposed deadline and give negotiators another shot. After the British Prime Minister and the European Commission President agreed Sunday to go the extra mile, officials said in an agreement could finally be struck this week with just days to spare before the UK leaves the EU single market and customs union. 48 hours of intense diplomacy injected fresh momentum into a process that had seemed to be reaching the end of the road last week. One person close to the negotiations said that a disastrous dinner between Johnson and the commission chief on Wednesday had forced negotiators to confront the possibility of failure. But a new UK proposal floated with the EU over the weekend on the biggest outstanding disagreement, how to create a level competitive playing field for businesses on either side of the channel. And this just might break the deadlock. In other news, Trump Georgia election challenge is rejected. In Atlanta, President Donald Trump has lost his latest legal challenge, seeking to overturn Georgia's election results, with the state's Supreme Court rejection late Saturday of a case from Trump's campaign and the Georgia Republican Party chairman David Schaefer. The suit, similar to other Trump legal team challenges, which made baseless allegations of widespread fraud in Georgia's presidential election, was initially filed on December 4th and then rejected by the Fulton County Superior Court because the paperwork was improperly completed and lacked the appropriate filing fees. The case was appealed directly to the state Supreme Court. In a brief order, justices wrote that petitioners have not shown that this is one of the extremely rare cases that would invoke our original jurisdiction. Meanwhile, the campaign of Georgia Republican U.S. Senator Kelly Loeffler disavowed a photo of her posing with a longtime white supremacist at a recent campaign event. Loeffler did not know who Chester Doles was when she took the picture, her campaign spokesman Stephen Lawson said on Sunday. There's a picture of police officers outside of the Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine in New York City. New York police officers carry a suspected gunman on a stretcher down the steps of the Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine on Sunday in New York. The man was fatally shot by police after he began firing two semi-automatic handguns at the end of a Christmas choral concert. A detective, a sergeant, and an officer fired 15 rounds after the man started shooting just before 4 p.m. at the church, which is the mother church of the Episcopal Diocese of New York. No other injuries were reported. All right, we're going to continue on with news of statewide importance. There are no obituaries today, local obituaries, but we will be reading a couple articles about some national figures. Report blames national Democrats for Iowa caucus delays. In Des Moines, a new audit report blames the National Democratic Party's involvement in the Iowa caucuses for problems that delayed the results for days at the beginning of the 2020 presidential nominating battle. The report commissioned by the Iowa Democratic Party criticized the national party's role in delaying development of a mobile phone app used to collect data from caucus sites and in demanding a last-minute data conversion tool that failed on caucus night, according to the Des Moines Register. But the report released Saturday also said that state Democratic Party should have bolstered its backup phone system for compiling results, which was overwhelmed on election night after the rollout of the app was slow. Without the DNC's intervention in that process, the Iowa Democratic Party may have reported results in real time as it intended. The Associated Press opted not to call a winner in the February 3rd Democratic caucuses because of lingering concerns about whether the results as reported by the party were fully accurate. The report said the state party delayed signing a contract with the app developer for several months after the Democratic National Committee raised questions. That delay left Shadow Inc. with far less time to create and test the app. In the weeks before the caucuses, the National Party also demanded that the app developer provide real-time access to raw data so that it could double-check the state's party math. But the tool that was created to convert the data into a format that the National Party could use produced errors that prompted the National Party to halt the release of results on caucus night until the discrepancies were resolved. Democratic National Committee officials who didn't participate in the audit report defended their efforts to double-check the results. The need for the Iowa Democratic Party to include a quality control check in their system was validated by numerous press reports, which found errors and inconsistencies in the initial caucus results, spokesperson David Bergstein said. The underlying technical problems were caused by errors from the Iowa Democratic Party's vendor. Okay, we're going to move on now. As I mentioned, there are no local obituaries, but Charlie Pride, the country's first black country music star, dies at age 86. In New York, Charlie Pride, country music's first black superstar, whose rich baritone on such hits as Kiss an Angel Good Morning helped sell millions of records and made him the first black member of the Country Music Hall of Fame. He has died at age 86. He died Saturday in Dallas of complications from COVID-19. I'm so heartbroken that one of my dearest and oldest friends, Charlie Pride, has passed away. It's even worse to know he passed away from COVID-19. What a horrible virus. Charlie, we will always love you, Dolly Parton tweeted. Pride released dozens of albums and sold more than 25 million records during a career that began in the mid-60s. Some of his hits include Kiss an Angel Good Morning, Is Anybody Going to San Antone, Burgers and Fries, Mountains of Love, and Someone Loves You, Honey. He had 3 Grammy Awards, more than 30 number one hits between 1969 and 1984, and won the Country Music Association's Top Male Vocalist and Entertainer of the Year in 1972. He was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2000. The Smithsonian in Washington acquired memorabilia from Pride, including a pair of boots and one of his guitars, for the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Ronnie Millsap called him a pioneer and said that without his encouragement, Millsap may never have gone to Nashville. To hear the news tears out a part of my heart, he said. Other black country stars came before Pride, namely DeFord Bailey, who was a Grand Ole Opry member between 1927 and 1941. But until the 90s, when Cleve Francis came along, Pride was the only black singer signed to a major label. In 1993, he joined the Opry cast in Nashville. "They used to ask me how it feels to be the first colored country singer," he said to the Dallas Morning News in 1992. "Then it was the first Negro country singer. Then it was the first black country singer. Now I'm the first African-American country singer. It's about the only thing that's changed. The country is so race conscious, so eaten up with colors and pigments. I call it skin hangups. It's a disease." Pride was raised in Sledge, Mississippi, the son of a sharecropper. He had 7 brothers and 3 sisters. In 2008, while accepting a Lifetime Achievement Award, he said he never focused on race. "My older sister one time said, 'Why are you singing their music?' But we all understand what the y'all and us syndrome has been. I'm never seen as an individual. See, I never as an individual accepted that, and I truly believe that's why I'm where I am today." Okay, in addition to that, another arts legend, John Le Carré, dies at age 89. John Le Carré, the spy-turned novelist whose elegant and intricate narratives defined the Cold War espionage thriller and brought acclaim to a genre critics had once ignored, has died. He was 89. Le Carré's literary agency, Curtis Brown, said Sunday that he died in Cornwall, southwest England, on Saturday after a short illness. In such classics as The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and The Honorable Schoolboy, Le Carré combined terse but lyrical prose with the kind of complexity expected in literary fiction. His books grappled with betrayal, moral compromise, and the psychological toll of a secret life. In The Quiet, Watchful Spymaster George Smiley, he created one of 20th century fiction's iconic characters, a decent man at the heart of a web of deceit. For Le Carré, the world of espionage was a metaphor for the human condition. All right, we're going to continue on now. 5 things that can happen in the election of 2024 that we can do better. This year's contest went remarkably well, but there's room for improvement. This is by David Levine. We have not yet seen evidence that would cast doubt on the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election. Even with the unprecedented challenges of a global pandemic, the threat of foreign interference, civil unrest, and greater turnout than any time since 1900. That counts as a resounding success. Once the final tallies are certified, we need to thank the election administrators and poll workers whose historic efforts preserved American democracy. After that, we need to assess what worked best and what needs to improve, so we can identify achievable steps to make future elections even more secure. Based on what we know so far, here are 5 things that should be on the U.S. election to-do list. Number 1, all jurisdictions should have paper backups. Counties in 8 states are still using paperless voting equipment exclusively. We need them to transition to paper-based systems, providing financial resources if necessary. Voting equipment without an auditable paper trail can produce results that are inconsistent with voter choices, either because of hackers or a technical failure. In 2020, more than 90% of the votes that were cast on paper-based voting equipment, including all the states President Donald Trump is contesting or that haven't been called. That's an improvement over the 2016 election, when 80% of the votes had a paper record. The goal for 2024 should be 100%. Number 2, more audits before official results. All states using voting equipment with a paper trail that could be audited should conduct robust audits before election results are certified. This will ensure all ballots are counted correctly. It will also allow discrepancies to be remedied and reflected in the final results. If any issue threw off the count, election officials would be even more likely to spot it and recreate an accurate count with paper records. Number 3, all jurisdictions need backup manual processes. all areas without backups for each of their their election technologies must obtain them. No technology is infallible. Each piece, including electronic poll books, voting systems, and online voter registration websites, have vulnerabilities that can be exploited or could experience technical failures. As we saw with the 2020 presidential election, safeguards such as backup paper poll books ensure that election infrastructure failures only slow down voting rather than to stop it. Number four, bolster the mail-in balloting process. Due to the pandemic, far more voters requested absentee ballots this year. Preliminary evidence suggests that relatively few of these ballots have been rejected. Unfortunately, U.S. postal data also shows that at least 150,000 ballots arrive the day after the election. To prevent this from happening again, there should be an investigation of USPS processing of election mail. It should determine how many ballots relate to election offices through no fault of the voter. And number five, states should also adjust their deadlines. For the next election, deadlines need to be updated to reflect the realities of mail balloting and provide even more options for returning ballots, including more ballot drop boxes and in-person drop-off locations. These measures would not only improve the administration of mail-in voting, they would counter the misinformation and disinformation surrounding mail-in ballots that we've seen throughout the 2020 cycle. We're going to continue on now to other areas and stories of interest. The new Iowa Senate president predicts incredibly exciting session in Des Moines. And first of all, there's a picture of Jake Chapman, who is the new presiding officer in the Iowa Senate. And there's also a picture of State Senator Randy Feenstra, left, laughing with Senator Jake Chapman of Adele in the Iowa Senate chambers on June 3rd. Fresh from his third election win, Adele Republican Jake Chapman is ready to take on a new challenge as the presiding officer in the Iowa Senate. Chapman said he was honored to be chosen recently by his 31 majority GOP colleagues to move into the Iowa Senate's second most powerful position as the chamber's next president when the 89th Iowa General Assembly convenes on January 11th. Chapman succeeds West Des Moines Republican Charles Schneider, who did not seek re-election. Chapman, age 36, has been a leading proponent of conservative causes such as tax cuts, abortion restrictions, and gun rights. He brings a sometimes fiery passion to a new post that oversees management and decorum during floor debate in the ornate upper chamber steeped in tradition. The father of five is also an emergency medical technician who operates an ambulance service. He recently spoke with the journal Des Moines Bureau about the upcoming legislative session and his new role. Question: why did you want the job as presiding officer? Answer: it's really a privilege to serve in this new role. Over the last number of years, I think I've truly demonstrated a breadth of knowledge when it comes to the rules and applying those in the chamber. Also, being able to lead our caucus on important agenda issues that we care deeply about. As president of the Senate, I'll continue to fight for those issues that Iowans care about and certainly those issues that our caucus cares about. Question: how will you approach the position and what do you think the role of the presiding officer should be? Answer: I think you'll see some differences than in the past. We have a rich history of tradition and decorum in the chamber, and I think you will see a lot of that tradition continue. I suppose there won't be a lot of change from that aspect, but don't be surprised if time to time the president of the Senate steps down to engage in some debate. That may be a change that will be coming this year. Question: sometimes things get heated during floor debate, and if you've been involved in and you've been involved in some of those situations, how will you approach your new duties, which require a steadying approach in maintaining Senate decorum? Answer: historically, what we've seen is that the presiding officer sits in a chair and assures that the procedural motions are carried out properly and correctly. But when it comes to floor debate, that is something I'm passionate about. And from time to time, I will perceive that I'll be able to engage in some of those floor debates as well. We have a very strong president pro tempore, Senator Brad Zaun from Urbandale, as well as I look forward to those opportunities. And that goes on with some other questions. We're going to turn now to sports. Sioux City gets tourney work in prep wrestling. Helan looks to build on last 2 weeks at long lines. For the South Sioux wrestling team, Saturday's Arena Academy Sports Invitational at Long Lines was the first tournament of the season for the Cardinals. Before Saturday, South Sioux participated in a few duels, but the arena invite provided the first chance for many of the Cardinals to wrestle 2 to 4 matches in a day. The result was a 10th place finish in the 16-team tournament. While South Sioux was not in the upper half of the teams, the Cardinals still finished ahead of Omaha Westside, Lewis Central, and Council Bluffs' Abe Lincoln. In other sports news, Iowa men's basketball, Fran's 200th win. Hawkeyes hammer the Huskies for McCaffrey's milestone Iowa win. In Iowa City, many of Fran McCaffrey's 200 victories at Iowa have involved some sort of drama and intrigue. Number 200 was not one of those, but there are figures to be plenty of those sort of games coming very soon, including one later this week. The number 3-ranked Hawkeyes methodically shredded Northern Illinois 106-53 on Sunday at Carver Hawkeye Arena. They are gearing up for their much-awaited showdown with number 1 Gonzaga on Saturday in Sioux Falls. McCaffrey said it was nice to pause and reflect on all the players and coaches and other people who have helped him win 200 games at Iowa and become the second winningest coach in the program's history behind Tom Davis. This is a proud and storied basketball program, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to bring it back. But it was apparent that he and his players already were starting to focus on the task that awaits them later in the week at the Samford Pentagon. "We've been looking forward to this since we heard we're playing them," said junior forward Joe Weiskamp, who tossed in 20 points while playing only 19 minutes on Sunday. "I think the whole team has, and we have to take one game at a time, but now that game is here." So that will happen on Saturday. In other sports news, the Kansas City Chiefs shake off a slow start, but they clinch the AFC West. Patrick Mahomes took a 30-yard sack before he got the Kansas City Chiefs going in the right direction. They overcame a 10-point deficit and 4 turnovers Sunday to clinch their 5th consecutive AFC West title by beating Miami 33-27. In the NFL, the Green Bay Packers beat the Lions and clinched the NFC North title. The NFL Chicago Bears stopped their skid and beat the Texans. So that's it. Lastly, storms pushed the women's U.S. Golf Open to a Monday finish. Rain falls during a weather delay in the final round of the U.S. Women's Open in Houston. The latest U.S. Open Women's USGA Championship on the calendar will last one more day because of relentless rain that drenched the Champions Golf Course and forced suspension of the final round until Monday. Hinako Sabuno of Japan has a one-shot lead as she goes for her second major, but she never teed off on Sunday. The USGA moved up team times as early as possible on Sunday because of the forecast, and the final round was just over an hour old when thunderstorms in the area caused plays to be stopped. It never resumed, with about 3/4 of an inch of rain falling before there was no point in trying to restart. The turf in the December climate doesn't drain as quickly, and the heavy rain soaked the course Friday after the second round. There was standing water across the Champions even during spells when the rain subsided. So that will continue today. All right. We're going to go back and review what's going to happen in the weather this week as we begin to close for our today's reading. What's going to happen in the 5-day forecast? Today's going to be partly sunny, but only high of 28. Tonight, low of 15. Tomorrow, cloudy, high of 31, low of 13. On Wednesday, the sun will start to peak out, high of 33, low of 18. Sunshine and milder on Thursday, high of 42, low of 24, and a little more cloud cover, but mild temperatures on Friday with a high of 43. That takes us to the end of the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, which is Monday, December 14th. My name is Barb, and I've enjoyed visiting with you today. Please take care this week, keep safe, and enjoy your week. We want to thank the Sioux City Journal and Iowa Reading Radio, IRIS, for bringing you this broadcast. Thank you, and have a great week ahead.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book entitled A Culinary History of Iowa. And this article, actually it says chapter 2, is entitled Immigrants Influence Iowa's Food Traditions. Hundreds of thousands of pioneers and immigrants from many parts of Europe and beyond flocked to Iowa in the 19th and early 20th centuries in search of a better life, whether that meant economic opportunity, religious freedom, or the chance to create a utopian society. These newcomers brought a variety of unique food traditions with them and transformed Iowa's culinary history. Some immigrants, like the French Icarians, were motivated by ideological ideals when they settled in America. The new state of Iowa, specifically Adams County, became the promised land for Frenchmen and women pursuing their dream to create a communal utopian society where everyone was equal. By some accounts, their Icaria colony in southwest Iowa was the longest existing non-religious, purely communal experiment in American history. The first Icarian party arrived in Iowa in 1852. They purchased about 3,000 acres of land from the United States government at $1.25 per acre to build their new colony near Corning. Living conditions in the untamed lands of southwest Iowa were often harsh. Log houses, some without wood floors or windows, were the French settlers' only shelter against the brutal winter. Most of the Icarians' land was unfenced, unbroken prairie, and there was not one settler along the trail before they reached Icaria, according to some reports. Supplies for the colony often had to be hauled overland for hundreds of miles. Only a few basic ingredients, including milk, butter, cornbread, and bacon, formed the daily menu. As a communal society, the Icarians worked together on the farms and ate together in a communal dining hall, where evening meals were sometimes followed by music or lectures, spoken in French. Little by little, living conditions in the colony improved as the Icarians managed to establish a fairly successful agricultural enterprise. When wool prices skyrocketed with the outbreak of the Civil War, the Icarians thrived by selling wool and other supplies to the Union Army. While the war ended in 1865, trouble was brewing in the Icaria colony by the 1870s. Much of the conflict revolved around Little Gardens, according to an April 1921 article in the Iowa History Journal, The Pelham Pest. Earlier in the history of the Icarian community in Iowa, each family had been permitted to cultivate a little garden around their log house where flowers might be raised. Some families had planted vines and even fruit trees. Now that these plants were bearing fruit, the more radical members of the colony could not tolerate this violation of their rules against private property. The possessors of the gardens, however, clung to their little plots of ground. It wasn't much, but it was theirs. The authorities tried to settle the quarrel with a compromise. As each family moved from their log house to a new frame house, their little garden was to be given up. There would be no simple resolution to this dispute, however, which triggered open hostilities. The radicals claimed that the community had violated its constitution and announced their intent to withdraw. They also advocated an aggressive style of communism and appealed to a circuit court to revoke the charter granted to the community in 1860 on the grounds that Icaria was really a communist establishment instead of an agricultural society, as the Articles of Incorporation provided. By 1879, a group of younger progressive colony members had split from the older, more conservative members. This marked the beginning of the end for the Icarians' utopian experiment in Iowa. In 1898, members voted to end the colony. By then, it consisted mostly of elders who could no longer continue the hard work of operating the colony. The Icarian movement in America was over. The legacy of the Icarian movement endures, however. The French Icarian Colony Board of Trustees was formed in recent years and has been rebuilding the French Icarian village on a portion of original Icarian land east of Corning. The 1878 refectory, communal dining hall, and 1860 one-room Icaria school have been restored for tours and research. History comes to life at the French Icarian village through events like the annual Fête de Mai, Festival of Corn, which is held in the fall. The original Fête de Mai was a celebration held by the Icarians each fall after all the crops were harvested. The feast was served in the communal dining hall to everyone who came to help on the final day of corn harvest. In late September 2015, the Creston News Advertiser promoted the French Icarian village's fourth annual Fête de Mai, which included a four-course French supper featuring flavors of the Alsace region. It's a modern taste of the French Icarian's quest for utopia in Iowa. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.